a dominant idea in the United States, that you probably still, if you polled a majority of people in this country, you would find that they would say, this country should be welcoming of immigrants, that immigrants contribute to the strength and health and well-being of the country overall.
You are listening to a conversation with Nikhil Pal Singh, professor of social and cultural analysis and history at NYU in New York City. My big question: why does Donald Trump hate immigrants, the very people who made and make America great?
So why does Trump hate immigrants? Or how has the American far right made the immigration issue salient in ways that seem to cut against the grain of what we have described here as sort of the common sense that the country is a nation of immigrants? They've been able to stoke an anti-immigrant animus based upon attaching it to arguments about the distress of the American worker, particularly the loss of manufacturing jobs, and the sort of rising sense, really, of kind of just economic distress throughout the country, which clearly is real in the United States.
But for which Trump just has recently said he doesn't care.
He doesn't care.
He doesn't care about the economic status of American workers. He just doesn't want Iran to get a bomb.
Yeah.
He's so, not concerned about the economic status of American workers.
Right, right.
So it's remarkable he'd actually say something like that.
Sometimes Trump just tells the truth. And, you know, he said, I think about a month ago, he said, you know, how can we possibly pay for Medicare and childcare and all these other things when we have to fight all of these wars? But previous to that, what the Trump administration officials have said is they've said, we can't pay for Medicare and the welfare state because illegal immigrants are basically stealing from the coffers of the country, that there's all of this fraud, that there's all of this abuse, and it all relates to illegal immigrants. So they've tied illegal immigrants to the economic distress of American workers. They've tied them to a kind of fiscal crisis of the state. And then they've sort of linked them back, of course, to, again, these more archaic visions of sort of who is an American, right? So the idea here is that these people are really not Americans, that there is something called a heritage American, a true American, someone whose birthright really defines them.
And the supreme irony for me, and you mentioned this in your article for Equator, is that somebody like Stephen Miller, who is the architect of this wave of kind of, you know, proto or crypto or neo-fascism in the United States, his family comes from the shtetl, from Eastern Europe.
Stephen Miller's...
People who at the time when they migrated to the United States were considered garbage.
The same nativist currents that led to the immigration restrictions in 1920 that are building up from the turn of the century are very similar to what's been happening now. You know, those people despised Miller's ancestors. Most of these people were eugenicists, which is to say they thought one of the problems with immigration from Eastern Europe, and especially the immigration of poor people from the farmlands of Eastern Europe and southern Italy and so forth, was that they were genetically inferior stock, that they weren't kind of going to contribute to the American pioneer breed, and that they may also harbor all of these kind of foreign ideologies and kind of ideas that are going to destabilize or radicalize the country. It's very similar to the nativist discourse of today. Well, these were Stephen Miller's ancestors. These were also Gregory Bovino's ancestors. Gregory Bovino was the head of Customs and Border Patrol for a while. Bovino has said that the United States should deport 100 million people, you know, which is one of these really insane far-right ideas that has a certain kind of currency, you know, has a, mostly an online currency. But this is somebody who actually had a serious position inside the U.S. government. Well, his ancestors came from Calabria and were poor Italians who are basically seen as, you know, basically just a step above black people, if even that, when they arrived in the country in the late 19th century. So these kinds of currents of kind of nativist racism, you know, which have recurred throughout American history, that are now being advanced, these people don't even really know, you know, what they're doing. It's quite remarkable, and you're right. It's a deeply ironic part of this story.
Let's get back to the more prosaic. I mean, at the moment, the figures here, Department of Homeland Security claims to have deported about 622,000 people, mm-hmm. and that more than 1.9 million have voluntarily left. Close to 70,000 people are now being held in immigration detention facilities. Now, this is terrifying.
Yeah, and all of that's as of January 2026. So you know, I think these numbers have grown since then.
Well, let me ask you, like, what's the story with the masks and the plain clothes? Like, the guys who are coming to seize people off the streets, drag them down, you know, tie them up, you know, crush their face into the pavement, drag them away. They're in plain clothes. They're wearing masks. The New York governor... Mrs. Hochschild wants to ban face masks, and you know, back when Kristi Noem was the head of Homeland Security before she got fired, deportations, arrests, there's a spectacle to it. There are film crews who are involved, and there's this kind of fascist aesthetic, like Greg Bovino with his getup that kind of looks like he was a Gestapo agent. Like, what's the story here? There's a kind of a, you know, they're seeking to turn their acts of seizure and deportation into memes. Mm-hmm. What's the story here?
Well, you know, this kind of builds on the previous question about why Trump hates immigrants, right? Which is, does Trump really hate immigrants, or have immigrants been a kind of a convenient mechanism through which to create a political constituency by defining this notion of the heritage American? Create a political constituency, and then also create an institutional project. And the institutional project here has been essentially to, again, ratchet up an internal policing apparatus in the name of immigration. But that internal policing apparatus for Trump is clearly partly about immigration. It's partly about threatening his political opponents. He sent the immigration police into very particular places. He's talked about using immigration police in elections.
There are fears that, you know, in the midterm elections 6 months from now, the key polling stations will be totally swamped by
ICE agents.
Dragging people out of line.
This is a mechanism of political intimidation. You know, and that's where the masks come in. You know, it's essentially, again, to say, you know, we get to do what we want, and we can do it with impunity, and you have no recourse. Not only do you have no recourse, we're going to take away the possibility that you can even identify who we are. It is truly terrifying.
And turning it into a spectacle, into something that can be transmitted on Truth Social.
For sure, the spectacle part of it, and the generation of memes and kind of slop imagery and narratives has been, you know, part of all of this, because a big part of how Trump operates, and a big part of what governance is now in the United States, and maybe increasingly in many parts of the world, where social media and kind of virtual realities now dominate over our material reality, is that Trump is interested in kind of narrative capture and remaining at the center of an attention economy, you know. And I think there's a sense that you capture narrative, you capture attention, you create the reality by dominating the narrative, and you know, people are kind of fixated and held there, and then you move on to the next thing. You know, so it's I've called it in the piece a series of smash and grab operations, right? So to go back to where we started the conversation, Maduro was a smash and grab, right? Blowing up boats in the Caribbean is a smash and grab. An operation in LA, you know, over 2 weeks, then another operation in Chicago, and then another operation in Minneapolis. But see, what's happened...
These are kinetic operations.
Yeah, they love this idea of kinetic action, that they're really doing something that involves kind of an expression of their real power, right? Their real power to kind of enact violence. And that is the illustration of the fact that they are in control and that they are directing history. You know, but the reality is that when you start to kind of not get fixated on the moment and on the spectacle, is you start to have the ability to perceive a different kind of pattern. And that's, again, part of the reason why I wrote this piece and tried to give a name to something called Homeland Empire, which is that Homeland Empire is not really generating new realities. I mean, to some degree, of course, it generates realities for Nicolas Maduro. It generates realities for people who are caught up in ICE, you know, prisons or police operations. It has material effects. I'm not saying that it doesn't, but it's not generating kind of a new organization of the country. Ultimately, one of the things that happened in Minneapolis was you saw where the power really was. The power wasn't actually in the operations of ICE dropping in and kind of engaging in these kind of spectacles of violence. Of course, that resulted in terrible tragedies. But the power was in the organization of people in the city of Minneapolis.
The power was in a simple whistle.
The power was in a whistle, the power was in a set of phone calls, the power was in a set of protocols of how you communicate with your neighbors. The power was in people coming out every day and facing off against this violence. And the power was also the way in which that dynamic began to engender a real change in public opinion. Suddenly, you're not smashing and grabbing and moving on to the next thing and showing that you're dominant. Suddenly, you're bogged down in a situation where you're killing soccer moms sitting in their cars and, you know, killing other bystanders who are showing themselves to be protecting kind of ordinary citizens and engaged in sort of lawful protests. And, you know, this kind of resonates with our earlier discussion about what Americans really think about immigration. Well, Americans don't like the police coming in and abusing, you know, law-abiding protesters. People of the United States do not like that. And so the Trump administration found itself really like stuck, to use a word, in a kind of quagmire in Minneapolis. And then, of course, they realized they needed to pull out. And Noam lost her job. Bovino lost his job. They went a little low profile. They're still doing what they're doing. But the spectacle didn't work. It didn't work to generate a kind of a new mode of authority that people were willing to submit to. It's not an operation that is kind of creating, as I say in the piece, a new hegemonic consensus that this is how the country should be governed. If anything, it's engendering an opposition to that. You know, the Maduro thing happened so quick, people just, you know, kind of moved on. But the analog to what happened in Minneapolis is what's happening in Iran, where the United States once again thought, the Trump administration once again thought, kinetic action. We're going to go in, we're going to take out the leadership, we're going to bomb them into submission, we're going to get part of their oil, we're going to seize their enriched uranium, we're going to do something that no one has ever done, you know, and suddenly, you know, Iran is going to be subordinated to, you know, our vision of a Middle East dominated by Israel.
But ultimately, like getting back to this comparison, Venezuela, Iran, and what's going on in the United States, that the seizure, the invasion of Venezuela and the seizure of its president, who's now jailed in Bronx, in the Bronx,
right,
was flagrantly unlawful. And the and Israel-USA's attack on Iran was a violation of the most fundamental article of the UN Charter, Article 2.4, that says, you know, you can't use or threaten the use of force against another sovereign nation. And yet, the international community, starting with Western powers, say nothing about it. Like, you know, you go searching for, you know, Macron or Meritz or Starmer or in Canada, you know, Mr. Carney, saying, look, first things first, the invasion of Iran was unlawful. It violated the UN Charter.
Yeah.
No one's saying this. And so Trump and the administration have achieved something that perhaps no past president has achieved. I mean, back during the Vietnam War, there were all sorts of people saying the attack on Vietnam, the war on Vietnam is unlawful.
Yeah.
But nobody's saying that about Iran. Meanwhile, in the United States, they're seriously talking about it, restricting what it means to be an American citizen.
Yes.
And actually revoking people's citizenship. Trump's talking about, you know, they've got a list of 400 or 500 naturalized Americans. One wonders whether Ilhan Omar is one of them, to remove their citizenship.
Yes.
And that this idea that not all citizens are the same. Not all citizens have equal rights under the 14th Amendment.
Now, you're absolutely right that the goal of the Trump administration, and they've been very successful, has been to essentially destroy not only the idea that the United States has to follow rules, but the idea that there actually are any rules. Basically, the vision is that power decides in every situation. And this is one of the aspects of Homeland Empire, that there's actually no distinction between the domestic and the foreign. So really, we are in a situation where, you know, Maduro can be kidnapped, Iran can be attacked, even as the United States is negotiating with Iran. And people domestically can be, arrested, renditioned, potentially have their citizenships stripped from them by executive decree. Now, then there's all different kinds of resistance to that, as we've sort of talked about, to some degree, from the lower courts, from, you know, popular mobilization within the United States, not at the scale that needs to happen, certainly not from the Democratic Party, which is, you know, for the most part, acquiescent with the Trump administration on many aspects of its programs. And in some sense, the Democratic Party is in the similar structural position to the Trump administration, as are the Europeans. You know, they seem to essentially share some similar goals. They're hedging their bets. They're a little afraid of losing the United States patronage and security guarantee, even though it's unclear what that's actually worth now. And they're embroiled in their own efforts to kind of appease a right that is very hostile to immigrants, that is very hostile to Islam and to Muslims, and that has this kind of intense kind of pro-Israel fealty, which seems to be something that they think of as kind of the core of some kind of moral politics throughout the West, when clearly it isn't. When clearly we've been shown, really going quite a long way back to the persistent ways in which Israel has operated in relation to the Palestinians in terms of the occupation of the West Bank, absolute destruction and mass murder of Gazan people and Palestinians since 2023, and what has, of course, now been exposed as the dimensions and the depravity of the Israeli prison system and torture and rape, and the way in which Israel has sort of used war on its neighbors in Lebanon, in Syria, of course, now in Iran, to essentially create a situation of chaos that it imagines itself benefiting from, and drawing the U.S. into those conflicts and making the U.S. kind of the centerpiece of those conflicts. I mean, all of this should be a moment for a profound reckoning and rethinking of what it would actually mean to imagine something like, or to reimagine something like, a rule-bound order, which supposedly the United States used to say it stood for. But I think what we have really seen under Trump, and in a way, again, this is one of the ways in which Trump is a sort of a truth teller, is that the rule-bound order was, in many respects, a fig leaf of power and of the interests of powerful nation states. And when those rules didn't serve those nation states, they were quite happy to dispense with them. You know, and I think that we really are at the point historically, where what was created after World War II, a kind of global capitalist world system under the predominant power of the United States and governed through international institutions and through a certain kind of regulative process, has come apart. It no longer functions. Trump is the, you know, sort of maybe the final figure who will sound or is sounding its death knell. And what follows from this is unclear.
And on that note, in your article here, in one of his last interviews, the most cunning operative of post-war statecraft, Henry Kissinger, old Henry, mm-hmm. described Donald Trump as the type of personage who emerges at the end of a dying age, quote, to force it to give up its old pretenses.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, I think old Henry there was right. And I think one of the tremendous ironies of Trump, and we may be seeing it right now unfolding in China, is that Trump will be, for all his bluster about making America great again, will actually be the president who really helps to accelerate the advent of the post-American world, of a multipolar world.
I mean, he's a sign of that, but he's a harbinger of that, but he's also an agent of that.
He's a harbinger of that. He's the culmination of trends that have been pushing in that direction, but he's also an agent and an accelerant. Obama had a view, I think, that stable governance of the world system and kind of, in some ways, the continued preeminence of the United States involved a more cautious brand of imperial management. And that more cautious brand of imperial management meant really winding down the wars, not thinking about how you could sort of start up another one. And to really wind down the wars, you had to begin to create some set of agreements around Iran. Because remember, going back to 9/11, the architects of that war were famous for saying, you know, boys go to Baghdad, but real men go to Tehran. You know, they wanted to go into Iran. Wolfowitz even floated the possibility of an Iran attack in back in 2003. So the idea that the sights were on Iran. The Israelis certainly had their sights on Iran for a long time. This has been in the works for a very, very long time. But I think that Obama understood that the longevity of the American kind of international imperial project probably depended upon not doing something that was actually going to create another American war in the Middle East of unpredictable provenance and consequences. And then clearly we've seen that that's what's happened, that they completely underestimated Iran, that they underestimated the costs and consequences of a war of this kind. And again, this is the way they've kind of accelerated a kind of American decline, like quite literally, in terms of its world position. Now, maybe that's partly, again, by design, because if anything, what this does is that it kind of even shores up further the idea that homeland empire is the way forward. You know, that part of what the Iran war is likely to do is to sort of reinforce some of the tendencies that Trump had already put on the table to kind of retrench American power into the Western Hemisphere. And not all of that is going to be good.
And
to bring the war back home. I mean, certainly I think we'll see ramifications domestically because of this, the loss of this war. Some of the violence is going to ratchet up again around immigration. They're engaged in all kinds of dirty operations in Mexico right now. There's obviously talk of an invasion of Cuba. Playing in what my colleague and friend Greg Grandin calls the Empire's Workshop of Latin America has often been where the United States returns in order to sort of reanimate its kind of imperial ambition. And I think that's partly what we're seeing. And I think this is what we will see after Iran. And we may even see noise again about Greenland.
Nikhil Pal Singh, the last question.
Yeah.
Is the American Republic, is American democracy, quote unquote, forged and founded in the immigrant experience, is it robust enough? Is it strong enough and versatile enough and robust enough to withstand the enormous corrosive force of pressure that's being imposed upon it by Donald Trump and his billionaire techno-fascist
coterie. Yeah,
is it strong enough?
I think it's a good question to end on, and I think it's a good question that your listeners and all of us should ponder. I can't give you a definitive answer. I hope it's strong enough. There are signs that there is a lot of civic energy in the United States. We've talked about it in relationship to Minneapolis. In New York City, we see things happening with our city government, which we haven't seen in my lifetime. And I think it's a very exciting moment. Americans are political animals. Americans do not like to be bossed around. And Americans have a lot of capacity for civic action, which we've seen repeatedly, right? On the streets, in neighborhoods, in organizations. You know, this goes back to this sort of the Tocquevillian idea of the ideal of democracy in America. I think democracy in America does have a strong kind of civic and cultural basis. It is blocked in many ways by a sclerotic and deeply, perhaps fatally corrupt government and judiciary, at least at the highest levels. I think the wealth inequality in the United States is the sort of the third dimension of that corruption, which is that it's made the American ruling class, or certainly a small segment of the American ruling class, no longer feel like it really has any ties to the wider society, that it can kind of live with its wealth sequestered and bunkered in different places and sort of operate through this massive financial control and leverage that it exerts over the government. So we're facing extremely adverse institutional and economic circumstances when it comes to a kind of a civically organized democratic renewal in the United States. But I really think that is going to be the battle of our time in this country. And it's not one that, you know, has a certain outcome. I mean, I think it's one that will have its own kind of vicissitudes going forward. But I wouldn't be hopeless about the future. I really do think that we have an opportunity here to redirect the country in the coming period.
Nikhil Palsing, thank you so much for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor. We shall talk again. Let's talk in 6 months, around the time of the midterm election.
Sounds great, David. Appreciate it.
Nikhil Palsing is professor of social and cultural analysis and history at NYU, New York University. His scholarship focuses on the intersection of contemporary U.S. history and political theory. Singh's first book, Black as a Country, Race and the Unfinished Struggle for Democracy, was recognized as the best book in U.S. civil rights history by the Organization of American Historians. Singh's other works include Climbing Jacob's Ladder, the Black Freedom Movement Writings of Jack O'Dell, Race and America's Long War, and Reconstructing Democracy, Black Intellectuals in the American Century. We'll link to Nikhil Palsing and his article for Equator, Homeland Empire, at greenplanetmonitor.net. We'll also post our complete conversation, which went on for a while. That's it for today's GPM, a joint production of Earth Chronicle Productions and 93.3 CFMU-FM, Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Blueberry, and on Canada's Harbinger Media Network. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program was created by the Unison Fund to support Canadian music industry veterans. For more information on this lifeline of hope, visit unisonfund.ca.